Welcome to the Southern Ground Podcast, provided by Alabama Extension through Auburn University. Extension educators Shane Harris and Dr. Chip East discuss seasonal lawn and garden topics, address common questions, and provide the practical solutions you want to know. Let's dig into our Southern Ground.
I'm Shane Harris, and joining me again for this Southern Ground Podcast is Dr. Chip East. And we're continuing our conversation here with Dr. Dave Hahn, who serves as our Extension Turfgrass Specialist here with Auburn University and Alabama Cooperative Extension System. So welcome, Chip. Welcome, Dave. And we were talking about at the end of the podcast prior to this one was selecting turfgrass. And we ended this previous conversation on managing the lawn, looking at the overall maintenance characteristics. So we want to pick up now and talk about these different turfgrass selections that are out there and give you the pros and cons of each one.
Yeah, and I think what I'll do is start with the species that I think requires the most in terms of fiddling with it, money and time, and that would be Bermuda grass. So Bermuda grass, and whether we're talking about the common Bermuda grasses that you can start from seed, or the hybrid Bermuda grasses that you need to do vegetatively. Usually that's by sod, sometimes sprigs or plugs. Those grasses require the most fertilizer. When we talk about the fertilizer requirements of turf grasses, usually we express that in terms of how much nitrogen do they need per 1,000 square feet of grass. Okay, we don't usually use acres when we're talking about home lawns just because of the size of most people's lawns. And so with Bermuda grasses, they need around 4 to 5 pounds of actual nitrogen per 1,000 square feet during the growing season to really be growing well and looking good. Now, if you want grass that's growing super fast, you can certainly give it more nitrogen, okay? If we were talking about a football field or a fairway on a golf course someplace where they're getting divots taken out of it all the time, and you need to grow really fast. Those applications, yeah, they're going to use a lot more nitrogen than that. But for a home lawn, 4 to 5 pounds, maybe 6 in, let's say, Florida or the Gulf Coast, you know, regions where the growing season is a little bit longer than, farther inland in the south, especially at high elevations. But that's in contrast to say some other grasses which require less nitrogen. So that's one thing. And of course, because it grows so fast, it requires more nitrogen, but also because it grows so fast, it's going to require mowing. And we talked about this last time on the podcast, right? Most Bermuda grass lawns are going to look a lot better if you can mow them twice a week in the middle of the summertime, at least from about June, July, August, first part of September. Okay. That's probably the only of the southern turf grasses that I would recommend mowing twice a week if you can. Now, Bermuda grasses also have some advantages to the fast growth, which is they do tend to choke out weeds better than certain other grasses, especially if you're fertilizing them a lot, right? So there's that advantage. They have a few pest problems, but nothing that really stands out as, oh man, if you have Bermuda, you got to watch out for this particular pest, right? So with Bermuda grass, it's mostly fertilizer and mowing, irrigation on it. One of the really nice things about Bermuda grass is that if you don't water it, it will stop growing. It will go dormant, just like it does in the wintertime when it's cold. And sometimes people don't like that because who likes to look at, you know, brown grass in the summertime? But it's not dead. It's just dormant. And Bermuda grass can survive dormant through droughts that last months. I mean, in Bermuda grass's native environment, it's from a tropical Africa and Asia in areas where they have the distinct wet and dry seasons. So it's used to going 5-6 months without hardly any rain at all. And it can come back from that. If you don't necessarily need it to be green in the summer and can stand having a dormant lawn, it's a great choice for just requiring zero water in the summertime if we have drought conditions.
Dr. Hahn, if you were going to water it, when is the best times to water and how many inches or how much should we water each week?
For almost all of the turf grasses, you're going to want to water, well, let me put it this way. The grass is going to want to receive and use about an inch or an inch and a half of water every week. That doesn't necessarily mean you need to water it that much, because if it rains, well, that's just free water falling out of the sky that the grass can use. But, you know, if we get into a period where maybe it's only raining about a half inch or three quarters inch in any given week, you can definitely use your irrigation to supply the grass with the other, you know, three quarters of an inch of water that it might need to keep it growing really actively. And that's true, like I said, for pretty much any species of grass. But the timing early in the morning is usually my go-to time to water grass. Anytime from after dew has already formed on the grass naturally till about maybe 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, when the sun starts to really beat down on the grass. And that's just to reduce the amount of water that you lose to evaporation while you're irrigating. I mean, if you irrigate at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the middle of July on a bright sunny day, or even a hazy sunny day, you can lose up to 20 to 30% of the water that comes out of your hose or your irrigation head to evaporation before it even soaks into the ground. And if it never soaks into the soil and the plant's roots can't get it, it might as well not have even been there at all. The only people who benefit is the water company at that point.
We're paying for that water, right?
And so watering first thing in the morning when it's cooler, when the sun's not beating down on it, definitely saves you some water. And if you wait until dew's already formed on that grass naturally, which is usually it starts happening, what, about 2 or 3 in the morning? You know, depends on the weather. But then you're not extending the amount of time that those leaves are wet every day. And so you're not, you know, making the habitat more suitable for a fungus or an insect that likes a wet canopy.
The next one on the list is zoysia grass. So tell us a little bit about the pros and cons of that. That's a very popular grass, and as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of different selections and varieties that are out there to choose from. Sometimes that can even be somewhat confusing about which one's the best one to get.
Oh, you're not kidding about that. Zoysias are great. They have a lot of advantages. One is, especially the newer zoysias, like we talked about on the last podcast, are pretty shade tolerant for a grass. They have a great color, nice density. And another quality of newer zoysias, again, things that have come out since about 2010 or so, are the fact that they grow pretty quickly compared to older zoysia grasses. So one of the most prevalent zoysia grasses of the 20th century was one called Meyer, okay? And this grass has been around since the 50s, okay, 1950s. It was very good looking, but not all that fast growing. If that's your benchmark for the growth rate of zoysia grass, then some of the newer zoysias are going to surprise you because they grow a lot faster. So they'll require more mowing. They don't require very much more nitrogen, though. So the nice thing about zoysias is almost all the zoysias will look really nice with like 2 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. Okay, and remember with Bermuda, we were up in the like 4 to 5 pound range, right? So about half as much nitrogen as Bermuda needs. Again, if you need it growing faster, you can give it a little bit more, but unlike Bermuda grass, zoysia grass does kind of hit a cap as to how fast it grows with less nitrogen input. Okay, it's also more cold tolerant than Bermuda grass is, generally speaking. So Bermuda grass is fairly cold tolerant. I mean, you can grow Bermuda grass well into the upper south. Okay, you know, I've seen it being successful in Louisville, Kentucky, and along the Ohio River in general. But if it does get really cold in the wintertime, especially an extended period of time of cold weather with no snow cover to help insulate the grass, you can get winter kill on it. And zoysias tend to be much more tolerant of freezing weather than Bermuda grasses are. So that's an advantage too. One of the disadvantages is just the price. Zoysia grasses, the vast majority of them have to be planted vegetatively. So you're talking getting sod or maybe plugs, you know, or sprigs. And that's generally a more expensive way to establish grass than seed, just in general. And zoysia sod is more expensive than Bermuda grass sod is. So the upfront costs of buying a zoysia grass lawn are going to be more than with a Bermuda grass lawn. But it does require less nitrogen, and it requires a similar amount of irrigation to be, you know, again, growing and active, like Bermuda grass, oysia grasses are also really good at handling drought just by going dormant. But if you want them to stay green, you're probably going to have to give most oysias a little bit more water than most Bermudas to keep them green. When it comes to something like centipede grass, that's the one I think we mentioned last time that requires the least amount of nitrogen, grows very slowly compared to zoysia and to Bermuda and to St. Augustine grass. And so, again, that's both a plus and a minus, right? The plus of slow growth is you don't have to mow it as much. The minus is if something does happen, it doesn't fix itself as quickly because it just can't grow back in as fast.
That's where I described it as being a little bit finicky or moody, especially the environmental conditions. It seems it doesn't like a lot of maintenance. Chip mentioned about tender love and care earlier for some of the grasses. It just sort of just leave me alone type grass.
It is. It's kind of like the feral kid of turf grasses, you know, the one that like seems to thrive the best, the least you do to it. More people, I think, get themselves into trouble with a centipede grass lawn by doing too much to it than by ignoring it. If you want a grass that you can just ignore and just mow it every so often, I would choose centipede grass. The only caveat to that would be, of course, centipede grass does not have great cold tolerance. So if you live in a colder part of the South, it's not going to be the best choice for you. But if you want something that you can just kind of put it there, and it'll survive. It may not look as pretty. It won't if you don't do anything to it, but mow it. It won't look as pretty maybe as a well-maintained zoysia, St. Augustine grass, or Bermuda grass lawn would, but it'll survive that a lot better.
Seems like watering is the number one factor to keep it happy, especially during the late summer.
That's right. It's not as drought tolerant as the other grasses. Now, it is a warm season grass, so it still can go dormant and come back after, you know, a month or two. But it's centipede. It doesn't grow very fast, and so it takes a lot longer to fill back in when it comes out of dormancy in the spring or when it comes out of dormancy after a drought. And so what sometimes happens is, especially in the fall, like you said, late in the year, if you let it go dormant because of drought, and in a lot of the southeastern United States, the fall is our driest time of the year, right? So if it goes dormant because of drought in the fall, it probably won't have time to really do much growth if it does start to rain, say, late fall before it's cool enough that it's not growing because it's of the temperature. And so you can get into these cycles where the centipede grass is just like dormant for, you know, 4 or 5 months in a row. And when it's dormant, it's not out competing weeds. And so that's, I think, another reason why it gets its reputation of being finicky. It's just, it's so slow growing that if something happens to it, it doesn't recover very fast.
I've had people, I've recommended centipede before, and I do like it. And someone said, oh, no, we can't plant that. It'll get in the pasture because it's right beside their house starting the pasture. And I'm like, well, if you fertilize, if you maintain the pasture like you're supposed to fertility-wise, we won't have to worry about centipede. It'll grow to the fence and stop.
That's right. The only time I've seen centipede grass take over from Bermuda grass or Bahia grass, which is another grass you can have in a pasture, is when you just don't fertilize it.
Right.
That is the type of environment that you find centipede grass out in the wild in. It was first found in southern China, and they have soils there that are really similar to the southeast United States, where they're high clay content, acidic, low fertility, okay? You know, if you ever tried to garden in the south, you know this, right? And that's just where it's from. And if you give it those conditions, it'll like it. But if you give it a condition where you're fertilizing a lot, you know, other things will outcompete it very easily. And then St. Augustine grass, right? So St. Augustine grass, the reason why I'm mentioning it last is because I think it has kind of the most restricted geographical area in the southeast where we'll find it really does well. That's just because of its really bad cold tolerance, right? But if you're on the Gulf Coast or right on the Atlantic coast from about maybe, I don't know, South Carolina down, and definitely in Florida, you will be able to grow St. Augustine grass really well. Now, that's a grass which, I don't think we mentioned this before, but it has a very striking appearance compared to most other turf grasses. Very wide leaf blade, very waxy, almost looks like it's artificial, like plastic or something the first time you see it. Okay, so classic example of this is like the Northerners who go down to Disney and there's St. Augustine grass all over Orlando, right? And they're just like, what is this grass? It doesn't even look like grass. Heck, I've even had people you know, some former students of ours at Auburn from Alabama, from the Birmingham area, used to looking at zoysia grass and Bermuda grass, take jobs in Florida, and they're like, this St. Augustine grass, man, it just doesn't even really look like grass to me.
Either you like it or hate it.
It's very polarizing. Yep, it sure is. But appearance aside, it also is notorious for getting an insect pest called the chinch bug. And that is one thing which you always have to kind of be on your on the lookout for when you have St. Augustine, especially if you're in Florida or South Texas, because there's huge chinch bug populations there. And every new variety of St. Augustine grass that's been released in the past, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years or so, has come out with chinch bug resistance. And then the chinch bugs have eventually overcome that resistance and you know, adapted, and now we're able to feed on those varieties. So it's a never-ending tug-of-war, like it is with a lot of crops in general, right? Resistant variety comes out, pests overcome resistance, you know.
I want to ask you a question on the coarseness of the St. Augustine grass that you see in on the deep south, especially like in Florida. How does that affect the lawnmower when they're trying to mow that heavy grass? We talk about zoysia being thick, and it'll bog down a lawnmower, but is there a special technique to mow St. Augustine grass?
I don't think there's a special technique to mowing it. You just have to make sure your blade is sharp. St. Augustine grass is a lot of the varieties of St. Augustine grass like to be cut a little bit higher than other warm season grasses. And I don't, this is a good chance to mention this. You know, Bermuda grasses and zoysia grasses do really well in a home lawn situation of a mowing height of about 2 inches, an inch and a half. Bermudas, you can even get lower than that. Depends on how much you like to mow grass. Okay, if you want to keep your Bermuda grass lawn at an inch tall, it will survive that. But then you're talking about mowing it like 3 times a week in order to just not be overwhelmed with clippings. But St. Augustine grasses, a lot of those varieties are about, they'll do best at about 3 or 4 inches high. Part of that is because of how dense it is and how wide the leaf blade is. But there are some varieties of St. Augustine that you can cut shorter, about 2 inches. So it just depends on the specific variety of St. Augustine grass that you have. But the most important thing with it is just, and any really dense grass, is just to make sure that your blade is sharp. I don't know if most people sharpen their mower blades quite as often as we recommend. You know, mostly it's like when you really notice a problem with the grass.
I was going to ask that, especially on back on the zoysia grass. A lot of times we recommend a reel mower, which most people have a rotary mower, and I understand that. But would you really want to sharpen those blades more often? It's hard to get a clean cut. We're really on any of it. Drive slower, sharpen blades.
I think rotary mowers can do a fine job on a zoysia grass lawn. But, yes, you have to have a sharp blade.
And this is a good point to bring up, because if you're establishing the turf grass and then you've got to buy another lawnmower to cut this particular grass, that needs to be discussed.
For most vast majority of home lawns, a rotary mower is going to be just fine. I don't think you need to get into a reel for a home lawn. Now, some people like it. You know, the only thing about a reel mower is, yes, they're finicky to adjust, and really you can't sharpen them yourself. You really need to take those in to have those reel blades ground properly. I don't necessarily say never, ever use a reel mower on your lawn, but I do try to steer people away from that as much as possible. Rotary is going to be fine as long as it's in good shape. Make sure that the blade's sharp. Slowing down does help. You know, obviously, it takes longer to mow your lawn if you slow down a little bit, but you will scalp less if you slow down than if you, you know, go full throttle the whole time. That is for sure.
And the more level our ground is has a lot to do with it. When people ask about mowing heights, I'm thinking, what, in your yard, we might want to do a little higher, but it depends.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. You know, and one of the issues also is if you're mowing with just a regular old homeowner grade rotary mower, whether it's a walk behind mower or a riding mower, a lot of times the mowing height is not the knob you twist or the thing you adjust. It just has numbers on it, right? Or just a couple of notches on it. And you don't really know, you know, like my lawnmower is a walk behind mower because I don't have a very big lawn. And it says on it, oh, we can adjust the mowing height from 1.5 to 3 inches. But then when you go to adjust it, it's just a series of notches there, right? So in theory, that lowest notch probably is around 1.5 inches. But have I actually measured the grass after I've gone out to mow it? Well, actually I have, but that's just because I'm a nerd. And it is about an inch and a half. But you know, the way that you really would check that is you'd have to go out and stick a ruler in the grass and see how tall it is, yeah.
What about collecting your clippings? Would you collect zoysia grass clippings? It depends on how tall it is when you go a cut.
Yeah.
And this is highly debatable because some people like to take their clippings off the entire year from a cosmetic standpoint.
That's right. You know, from an agronomic standpoint, if the clippings are not just lying there on the surface after you mow, if they're falling back into the canopy, they're just free fertilizer, basically. And you don't really need to bag them. Now, if you're mowing often enough, then that can happen. If you are delayed in your mowing, you know, say it's like been raining every weekend for a month or something like this, you know, and you go out there and you're whacking the grass back down to, you know, 2 inches tall from like 4 or 5 inches tall, probably that's not going to happen, right? You're going to have so many clippings, they're going to clump up on the surface, they're going to block air and light from getting to the grass, and then you do need to bag them. Another time that I put the bag on the mower, in my personal case, but I think a lot of people have this happening too, I got pine trees in my yard. And when they're dropping needles, I pick those up. Because even with my mower, even if I have a mulching blade on it, those needles, if I don't put a bag on it in the fall, are enough to where they're blocking light from getting to the grass. Plus, it just doesn't look good, right? So sometimes, even maybe most of the time, when I personally put a bag on my mower, it's not because of the grass, it's because of something else.
One more question I'll end with is, we talked earlier about the fertilizing. When would you start fertilizing? You talked about, you know, it's May and it's starting to grow because that Bermuda's warming up. I have a lot of people ask me about fertilizing in March because they went out there and mowed their weeds, and they're like, well, I need to be fertilizing. I don't want the weeds to grow. When would you start the fertilizing? You talked about how much to put in a season. When would you start and end those applications?
Well, here's the main thing to remember, especially with the warm season grasses, Bermuda zoysia, centipede, St. Augustine, they like it hot, okay? And just because your weeds are growing in March, usually your grass is not really growing that much.
Usually it's a cool season weed that's growing.
Exactly. And if you fertilize in that time of the year, you're actually fertilizing the weeds and not the grass, because it's the right temperature for those cool season weeds to grow and not for your warm season grass. And even though we touched 90 degrees in March this year, right, we also touched 25 degrees, you know, and we really need to have consistent hot weather. I like to tell people for the deep south, again, you know, Atlantic coastal plain, Gulf coastal plain, mid-April to early May should be really when you put out your first, and really it ought to be early May for the upper south. And that's a long time to wait after that first bout of 80 or whatever, 85 degree weather in March, and everything gets green, but it's really not growing. And if you really want to get fancy about it and you have a soil thermometer, wait until you get soil temperatures in the 70s for, you know, consistently. And that's when the warm season grass is actually growing enough to make good use of that nitrogen, because you really want to put it out there when the grass can use it. Now, the only exception to that would be if you're using a 100% slow release fertilizer. So say, you know, you're made of money and you decide, I'm going to use only a slow release fertilizer on my lawn this year. Okay, well, that you can go ahead and put out early, because the slow release fertilizers, most of them don't release very much nitrogen when it's cold, and they'll release more when it warms up and the grass is going to be able to use it. But if you're using just a regular old, you know, mostly soluble fertilizer source, then yeah, I wouldn't put it out too early.
Think about when the grass is actively growing, and that certainly may not be in March.
That's right. And especially if you're worried about weeds, don't give the weeds food when it's too cold for the grass to use it, because then they're going to use it. The weeds are, yeah.
Well, we're going to wrap this podcast up. This is a part one, part two podcast, as we talked about selecting turf grass for the home lawn. Chip, we've gone to almost an hour in this podcast.
This is some good information. A lot of time and money is spent on the turf, so we need to be doing it right. We certainly appreciate Dr. Hahn for talking with us today. This has been excellent.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
And it's always educational when we have guests, specialists like yourself. We always learn from the trainings and the workshops that we do together. Every time we get together, we're always learning and picking up a few more tips, even after doing this for several years, Chip. So thank you, Dr. Hahn, for being with us. Thank you, Chip, again, for partnering with this podcast. If you're interested in more information about selecting turf grass, maintaining the lawn, or any kind of questions you might have, go to your land-grant university that's in your state or here in Alabama. It's the Alabama Cooperative Extension System. And go to www.aces.edu. And for more information, including a lot of these topics that we went in detail on, that we have publications on selecting turf grass for the home lawn. Go check it out. Do your research. Do your homework before you're establishing that lawn, because we want you to be successful, Chip.
Dr. Hahn wrote a lot of those publications that's on our website.
I helped out with most of them, yep.
Guys, thank you for being with us here as we talk about turf grass and selecting the right home lawn. We hope you'll join us for our next podcast as we dig deeper into other topics that you may have questions on. Thank you for listening to this episode of Southern Ground.
Southern Ground has been a production of Alabama Extension at Auburn University.